Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. When Simon and Garfunkel wrote It's All Happening at the Zoo, they might have been looking ahead to today's St. Louis Zoo, because a lot is happening. It's just recently been named one of the top five best zoos in the world. It's number four, and rated second and third best in the United States in separate polls. 3 million visitors a year testify to all of that, as does its reputation for excellence in research, education, and wildlife conservation. And it is free. With me in studio to talk about the zoo, its past, present, and future, is Dr. Jeffrey Bonner, the president and CEO. Welcome, Jeffrey. Nice to have you here. Congratulations on all that wonderful publicity.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, the zoo's going great guns this year. It's been a great year for us.
Every year seems to be a great year. You know, I have to ask at the outset, there was a lot of music in Forest Park yesterday with the Lou Fest, and I understand some symphony folks were over on your turf. Does that loud music affect the animals at all?
You know, we test decibel levels pretty regularly, and about 95 is fine for us. Believe it or not, fireworks actually come in right around there. It's not much louder than that. It's, I guess, the suddenness or the abruptness that can startle animals. But we pretty much condition them to be okay with it. The only odd thing that happens is that sea lions tend to give birth during the concert at Zufari. Don't ask me why.
Okay, I won't. We don't want to go there, as they say. What makes one zoo better than another?
Well, we always say that the best zoo is the accredited zoo closest to where you live. I think for me at least, it's the quality of the exhibits, the quality of the visitor experience, and of course underlying that, underpinning it, is the conservation programs, the research programs, the education programs. I happen to think that our zoo is the best in terms of the visitor experience. And in the only national survey that's ever been done, which was the Sagitt survey, we did come out on top. San Diego has got a great experience. New York, frankly, is not there. But New York has a better conservation program. I think San Diego has a better research program. So how do you pick the best one? You know, the one you like the most, I guess.
I think a lot of people were surprised because in one of the polls, the Omaha Zoo came in number one. I think that surprised a lot of people.
Yeah, it's a great zoo. Columbus is a great zoo. Those second-tier zoos, a lot smaller than St. Louis, Chicago, New York, and San Diego. But they've done some remarkable things, some wonderful things. I happen to think, having been to the Henry Dorley Zoo in Omaha, that the zoo is fabulous and there's not much else to do. So unless you're going to the College World Series, there's not a lot in Omaha. So,
give me some sense, if you would, as to what it takes. You've got, I think, 19,000 animals in the zoo, I think, or 600 species. What does it take to manage that?
Well, it's like a small city. You know, there's an incredible amount of infrastructure, life support that goes along with that. So we have all of those guys. You know, you mentioned well over 3 million visitors in the last few years. So, you know, there's a lot to do to care for them. very extensive education programs. We have conservation programs in 12 places around the world, two of them in Missouri, but the rest of them pretty far flung. And doing that is an amazing undertaking. So, and then you've got all the regular stuff, the public relations and the fundraising and all the things that go with it. So it's a big operation.
How large a staff do you have?
Well, we have 320 full-time staff, but we go up to 900 during the summer. So just hiring 600-odd people is an amazing thing, getting them trained, getting them out in the zoo. So almost 1,000 volunteers. So you've got a lot of people you're working with to make that zoo what you see.
When you talk about training, what sort of training are we talking about?
Well, every employee has to go through orientation. We want them to understand a little bit about the heritage, the tradition of the St. Louis Zoo. Of course, we want them to know how to give, you know, basic directions. We want them to know the basic skill sets that we require. So there's you know, that orientation is important. And then actually, we do an enormous amount of training. We have, I think, three full-time people training staff, upgrading them, giving them regular ongoing personal development, professional development skills. So there's an awful lot, again, a lot going on underneath the surface.
Yeah, you know, I want to get to the issue of conservation. I was just looking at my notes here. We had some months ago, we had John Newby in here, whom you know, I'm sure the Sahelo-Saharan Interest Group person. And we talked a lot about the conservation efforts that he's involved in along with the St. Louis Zoo. You're all over the world. What kind of work is actually going on?
You know, it differs in so many places. But if you look at the threats to wildlife, wild things, wild places, they seem to boil down to a pretty common cluster. So habitat loss, habitat fragmentation, degradation, so much of it just turns on the impact of human beings and as they encroach into wild places. And when you get right down to it, that's what we're working with. We're working with the interaction of plants, people, and animals. And I think in large measure trying to mitigate the things that happen because of humanity and the impact that we have on the natural environment.
Well, what are the most endangered species right now?
Well, there are quite a large number of species that are extinct in the wild. So I would say that, you know, obviously they're more than endangered. They're extinct in the wild. A lot of them only live on in zoos, several of those species at the St. Louis Zoo. I think when I look at endangered species worldwide, I would say you're finding threats in every place, but we're doing a lot of work in Oceania where the brown tree snake is moving from island to island. It's an arboreal snake. It lives in trees, and everywhere it goes, it simply wipes out all of the birds. So you're always looking at problems there. Throughout Africa, now poaching is at a level that really exceeds what it was 20 or 30 years ago when we seemed to have put a stop to it. In Madagascar, where we work, a lot of it has to do with the fact that the people there are extraordinarily poor. They're doing slash-and-burn agriculture. They're coming and cutting down the trees. They're burning them and then planting dry upland rice in those areas. We just have to give them alternate sources for making a living. In every case, it's a little different. And the species that are endangered, of course, vary by place to place. But there are so many that are just teetering on the edge.
I think most of us probably tend to think of a couple in particular. That would be the tiger and the polar bear.
Yeah. Tiger in particular, we have Siberian tigers. They're probably down to a couple hundred left in the wild. I would say that the Amur leopard, which is basically found in the same range, probably well below 50, maybe in the 20s. Mm. You're looking at a lot of, I think, very charismatic animals that are really right on the edge. Some wonderful different kinds of hoofstock, and particularly in Sahel Saharan, where we work, all of this very fragile environment and an awful lot of pressure on it. So, yeah, a lot of things that you would think would be fine are really, really not.
That puts a lot of pressure on places like the St. Louis Zoo, does it not, where you do have a responsibility, I'm sure, with these animals that are approaching possible extinction?
Yeah, sometimes it feels like triage, but our approach to conservation has always been what we call the flagship species approach. So, you know, if you save Grevy's zebra, which is one of the species we're working on in northern Kenya, which is down to a couple thousand, so not a great number. But if you save that species in the places where they live, you're going to save that place for all of the other plants and animals that that would normally live there. So by focusing on a single important species, you can really make a difference for thousands and thousands of species in the same locale. And that's really what drives a lot of the decision-making at the St. Louis Zoo. It's why you see wonderful charismatic species. Now, I have to say, we've taken on some species that aren't the least bit charismatic, like the hellbenders and the American burying beetles, and tried to make them charismatic. And darn if it hasn't worked in many cases.
Well, you'll have to educate me with regard to a hellbender. I have no idea what a hellbender is.
Well, hellbenders, wonderful. They're great big amphibians, 16, 18 inches. They live for 20 or 30 years. You've been over them. If you've ever floated on any of the faster rivers in Missouri, they live under flat rocks in those rivers. And they're down to, well, probably under 1,000. 75% of the world's Ozark hellbenders live in the St. Louis Zoo. So we're slowly, the ones that are breeding in the wild, we take their eggs out. We head start them. We hatch them at the zoo, wait till they're 4 or 5 years old, put them back in the wild. And then we were the first zoo to actually breed hellbenders. So we're fighting back. And we've really got to, I think, a bulwark against extinction there. And the problem, of course, for the hellbender is water quality. They're amphibians, so they're highly sensitive to anything in the water. And what we're finding is things like, well, we call them endocrine disruptors, but things like estrogen and estrogen mimics are in our water, and they're feminizing the males. And by the way, you're drinking that water. So, you know, you ought to think about that one for a minute.
Thanks. I'll try not to, but thanks for the tip anyway. How do you come up with these counts of how many animals are left in the wild, particularly for these endangered species?
Well, we're doing pretty regular census work in a lot of places. We, for example, our zoo is very active in Armenia with a beautiful snake, venomous snake, the Armenian viper. And we track them, and we actually developed a technology where we could put transmitters in a snake, and they do just fine with the transmitter. So we track them. We measure population densities. Oftentimes we extrapolate from that. You're not going to count every Armenian viper, but we can make some pretty good guesses. Also, we can spot trends. So for the hellbenders, they've been studying them for a long, long time, for decades. So we can go back, survey the same places, and see what the trend line is, which in many ways is just as important as the number of species or specimens that are actually left.
And dealing with the situation such as this, you mentioned that it's human encroachment, which has been a problem. In terms of trying to reverse the trend, I suspect, therefore, you have to have an education process going on with the indigenous people who are encroaching on some of these habitats.
The one thing we know is that if you don't have the cooperation of the folks that live there, whatever you do is not going to work. And that's the bottom line. Absolutely, education. In the case of the Grevy zebra, for example, they have two strongholds. One is in a place called Leowa Reserve and another reserve, Shaba, Buffalo Springs. And in that reserve, we find a good, healthy population. So what we're trying to do is get the folks that the native Maasai, Samburu Maasai, have ancestral lands that they wander around through. We're trying to get them to set aside big parts of their land so you can have a corridor. We've got to help them and understand why that's important. You've got to give them something. In this case, we put water to where their cattle graze. Reliable source of water in a very arid place is a wonderful thing. And finally, we say if you can maintain this conservation corridor and the plants and the animals all come back, we'll help you fund an ecotourism lodge and you'll have a constant source of revenue. Now, they don't want to live like Westerners. They want to live like Maasai. But if their children get sick, they want to send them to a clinic. If their children want to go to school, they want to send them to school. So they find it in their self-interest to do that. We're a large employer. You asked how we count animals there. We actually census animals, and we pay both men and women. Men go out with the cattle. Women stay a little closer to whatever habitation site they have. We pay them to do the census work. We give them GPS. Of course, they're illiterate, but they have a little chart, and they'll put X's through how many animals they saw. They'll note what the weather was. There's clouds, sun, and then they'll enter on the GPS. So we have this wonderful combination of high-tech and low-tech. And they bought into it.
And if they have that kind of responsibility, they'll be more attentive to the animal population in general, I guess.
Well, and they've come to understand the importance of preserving that environment. You know, the Maasai are natural conservationists. You may not know this, but Maasai own all the cattle in the world. They made a deal with God that said that if God gave them all the cattle in the world, they would never shoot any wild animal and would only eat cattle. Now, of course, they do kill lions, but, that's understandable. And so in the areas where the Maasai thrived, you've still got most of the natural floral base and fauna base there. You've got most of the animals that were always found there because they've protected them and they haven't utilized them.
The Maasai are fairly unique, are they not? As I recall seeing pictures of them in National Geographic or wherever, aren't they very, very tall, 6.5, 7 feet
tall?
Yeah,
they tend to be tall and thin and... And we do a lot of work now with Native American populations in the Arctic, with you would call them Eskimo, First Nation people. And they tend to be the exact opposite. Maybe it has something to do with climate. Who knows?
Is all of this run out of St. Louis? I mean, the groups that you have in various parts of the world, do they report to you, for instance, here, or are they autonomous?
Yeah, what a great question, because everything we do is collaborative. We're working with hundreds and hundreds of universities, with other zoos, with conservation organizations, actually with local governments. Really, a lot of it is for our 12 programs. We're centralizing all of that and coordinating those efforts. But then we're members of other programs where other institutions are doing that. By the way, same thing with breeding animals. It's all centralized, some of which we do ourselves and most of which is done in other zoos around the nation.
Once again, an indication that running a zoo is a lot more complicated than people might think.
Right.
Our guest in studio is Jeffrey Bonner, Dr. Jeffrey Bonner, who is the president and CEO of our St. Louis Zoo, our much honored St. Louis Zoo, much lauded. We'll come back and continue our conversation with him. I want to talk a little bit about polar bears when we come back.
Sure. And
we'll do that with our guest, Jeffrey Bonner. Stay with us. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with Jeffrey Bonner, who's the president and CEO of our St. Louis Zoo. We'll continue that conversation and talk about a collaboration the zoo is going to be conducting with the St. Louis Symphony. As a matter of fact, is already conducting that collaborative effort. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Missouri Auditor Tom Schweik is accusing Governor Jay Nixon of violating the state constitution by making budget cuts in 2012. Schweik released an audit today asserting that Nixon should not have blocked millions of dollars of spending that year because state revenues exceeded estimates upon which the budget is based. Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan says she will fight for new legislation that would let nursing home residents and their families have video or audio recording devices in their rooms to monitor patient treatment. The idea for the proposal comes after Madigan's office fielded complaints from nursing home residents and families concerned about safety and security. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Dr. Jeffrey Bonner. And Jeffrey, I want to get to the polar bears in a minute, but I did want to take a moment, too, to talk about this collaboration that you and the St. Louis Symphony, this agreement that you've entered into. Very generally, what is that all about?
That's a great idea. You know, there's so many things that happen at the zoo, some wonderful things at the symphony. So we found some areas where we kind of overlap. There's some wonderful music written for that has animals as part of the, you know, the sort of the ethos of the piece. And at the same time, you know, we love to have concerts at the zoo. We love to have people have a wonderful time. So it's a natural partnership.
Let's bring into the conversation for a couple of moments Adam Crane, who is the St. Louis Symphony Vice President for External Affairs. Adam, nice to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you, Don. Good morning, Jeffrey.
Good morning.
Adam, give
us... Good afternoon. Sorry.
That's okay. You're forgiven. Give us some sense, Jeffrey, of how the symphony and the zoo came together on this project.
Well, this is something that actually our music director, David Robertson, has been extremely enthusiastic about. We're always looking for partners across the community, and the St. Louis Zoo just seemed like a natural fit for us. It's an organization that is one of the great treasures of St. Louis, and we had just been brainstorming about what we could possibly do. So we actually kicked off the partnership officially over the weekend on Saturday. We had a concert with members of our brass section at right outside the Sea Lion Cove, I think is what it's called, in the Schnook Family Plaza in the center of the zoo. We had people just walking in. Little kids were dancing to the music. I mean, it was great. Perfect weather. Even our musicians were acting as animals throughout the performance. So. It was the kickoff to this. We also have a series of concerts, a family concert open to the public on October 26th here at Powell Hall, and we're basing that on John Lithgow's book, Never Play Music Right Next to the Zoo. So we are performing a concert featuring Sanson's Carnival of the Animals. So the musicians essentially have different movements. There's a piece called The Swan. I'm a cellist, so The Swan is for solo cello, and that's one of the movements in Carnival of the Animals. That's actually why I started playing the cello. Yeah. So very inspirational piece. It's going to be a fun-filled day. We have activities before the concert. There are going to be members of the zoo here. There's going to be a narrator from the zoo and from the St. Louis Symphony on the stage. So lots of activities with the zoo theme here at Powell Hall.
And you're not going to have competition from the Lou Fest in the October events, are you?
No. I'm sure we'll have competition from something, but no, it should be a competition-free Sunday, hopefully.
What do you see as the value of a program like this, Adam?
Well, I think just connecting music and anything science-related, anything with animals, people have a natural connection. There's musical themes to everything. So we just think that, again, the possibilities are endless. We look forward to continuing a partnership with the zoo. We don't want this to be just a one-off. We're hoping to have an annual partnership, and we'll be thinking of new things as we go along.
You know, mentioned that this is all a family-friendly project. I kind of thought that perhaps it would tilt a little bit in the direction of the kids.
It will, and even we will have some special concessions here. I was just reminded, zoo-themed. We'll have animal crackers, cotton candy, popcorn. So,
Flamingo-Aid, the pink lemonade.
Flamingo-Aid, yes, I remember that, and it should be, we'll see. I was told by our operations team that we can't bring in live animals in the hall, so I was hoping to maybe have an elephant, you know, walk across the stage, but I don't think that will work.
Who selects the music? Is that all the symphony's job, or are you going to get Jeffrey Bonner and his folks in on it as well? He's shaking his head no.
the zoo team, they have been involved in many of these meetings. Our resident conductor, Stephen Jarvey, will be essentially going through the selections, and he's co-hosting the concert. And our director of education, Barakia Boone, who's been our point person on the ground for the zoo, she's worked with Stephen and with the zoo to coordinate all of the repertoire and again, it's around, it's themed around Carnival of the Animals, which is a very family-friendly piece. So lots of activity on the stage during that performance, and should be a great time.
And what are those dates again?
The family concert's October 26th, and tickets are available now. You can just go to our website, stlsymphony.org.
Okay, we'll put a link to that website on ours at stlpublicradio.org. Adam Crane, St. Louis Symphony Vice President for External Affairs, thank you for being with us. Anything you need to add to this?
No, it's just we're thrilled to be partnering with the zoo, so thank you.
And I'm sure they're thrilled, Jeffrey.
Oh, yeah.
You can speak for yourself. Adam, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Yeah.
What do you think is the takeaway for the zoo for a project like this, particularly with kids involved as heavily as they're going to be?
You know, and Adam kind of alluded to it. You never know what's going to reach a child. So many people think there are so many learning modalities, so many ways that we learn, and all of us are blessed with different ways of doing that. And there is, you know, musical intelligence. There are people that connect with the world so much better in that way. And if you can make that linkage with just one kid, you've made a huge difference.
And there are so many fun songs, music pieces related to animals. That should make the project of deciding what to play fairly simple.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah. Now, back to the polar bears. We talked earlier about the encroachment that humankind has had on various habitats. Most of us are concerned about these pictures we see of polar bears sitting on ice cubes, and it brings us to the ultimate encroachment, which is climate change. And what is going on? Give us your perspective on that and how you're seeing it from your perspective at the zoo.
Well, there's no doubt that the climate is changing. People talk about global warming. What actually happens is that what we anticipate happening, what we're seeing thus far, is that you're really going to see just a lot of tremendous variation. So last winter in Missouri was incredibly cold. That there's a difference between climate and weather, of course. And what climate change means is that weather per se is going to become highly variable. Climate change, warming, global warming, operates differentially at altitudes and at the poles. So you're seeing the effects there in a much more pronounced and profound way. Polar bears are great icon species for that because they're marine mammals. They live on the ice. They cannot make a living on the land. So as the sea ice forms later in the year and disappears earlier the following year, as the period when they can make a living, if you will, gets shorter and shorter, it has a terrible effect on bear populations.
What can be done, what is being done to try to deal with this at that level?
Well, I think for us, we feel strongly that a legislative approach is probably the best thing to do. It's not to say that there aren't things that you can't do to improve your carbon footprint. And in fact, as a people, as a nation, there's so much we could do to mitigate our cumulative effect. But I also think at the same time that probably the ultimate solution to this is a legislative solution. You know, we're hopeful that this administration, the Obama administration, will take a more proactive approach, or that maybe after the next election, Congress can come together and take a more concerted action.
Are you concerned at all, again, with particular regard to the polar bear, that it's almost too late for them? There aren't that many out there from what I've read.
Not too late for bears. I think if we can slow and indeed reverse the period of warming that we're experiencing now, I think bears can make it. We will have a reserve population in zoos in North America and actually in other parts of the world. Bears are going to be difficult to reintroduce into the wild. There's some species that just require so much learning to be effective hunters. Most of the big cats are the same way. But we'll see. I think that we can hold on to those populations. I would certainly say all is not lost.
What does this present in terms of concerns or problems you might have in acquiring animals such as these, the bears, some of the big cats?
Well, actually, tragically, we're afraid it's going to become easier and easier to acquire them. You're finding more orphan bears. You're finding more stranded bears, more nuisance bears. Canadian, the bears are particularly in places like Churchill, where you find a big aggregation of bears before the ice forms. They're experiencing so many problems. Two orphans last year. There was an orphan on the north slope of Alaska. I'm just afraid you're going to see a lot more of that. So I would worry about too many, not enough.
I want to take this moment. We'll talk about expansion plans at the zoo. There are lots going on there in just a moment. But I'd like to get our audience into the conversation as quickly as we can. 382-8255 is our number. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you'd like to send us a tweet, do so at STL on air. And before we continue on to other subjects, we have a call from Riverview, and Jay, I think he wants to talk about climate change and its impact. Go ahead, Jay. You're on the air.
Yeah, guys. First of all, I want to say how I really like the evening programs you all do at the zoo. They're great. In fact, I go to more evening programs than I do the actual zoo. I need to go there more often. But, you know, I've learned a lot at your evening programs about the polar bears. You had a folks from Polar Bear International,
right.
And they talked about how endangered they are, how the sea ice is melting. And I just thought I'd let you know, I couldn't believe it, just on a competing station right 40 minutes ago, I heard Limbaugh say, the ice is actually growing again. Now, I don't believe him on most things, but I'd be curious about your comments. But keep up those wonderful programs at night. I learn a lot. I learned a lot about the passenger pigeon, which was hunted to extinction the other, in 45 years in the late 1800s, it was great. So keep it up.
Well, thank you for those comments. And that's the problem I alluded to earlier. There's a lot of variation. What happens is sea ice expands, it contracts. Some years there's more than other years. If you look at USGS, U.S. Geological Survey, has put together satellite images from space, and if you run those images over a 30-year period, it's indisputable that the ice is overall contracting. One year to the next, there's some variation. But when you watch the whole video, which is only a minute or two long, you'll see that the sea ice the expanse that it covers is dramatically down.
I hope that teaches Jay, by the way, not to listen to competing radio stations.
Yes, yeah, I was surprised when he even said
you're
that.
You're right.
there is no profit in that, Jay.
Yes.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for your call. Let's take another one from Rick in Brentwood. Go ahead, Rick.
Good morning.
Hi, go ahead.
My name is Rick Bauer. I own an auction company in St. Louis, Missouri. But I am in possession of a set of blueprints that were made for a proposed new cat house at the zoo, a Baroque style with a lot of ornate terracotta work on the outside of the building. The funds were not available. It never materialized, but the designs are absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, you know what? That's John Wallace, and he did those three gorgeous buildings on Historic Hill. And you're right, he did all the artwork himself. He designed it himself. He created those bas-reliefs and the sculptures. He did it on the railings within the building and, of course, the exteriors. He's a remarkable man. But, yeah, that's true. We didn't redo our cat area until after the first ZMD property tax passed.
Would they have any historical value to you as a donation from me? For your archival records?
We would love to have them. See, that's why we do these shows, so we can find people like you. We'd be delighted to take those. Thank you.
Could somebody contact me on how I might make arrangements to get those to you, sir?
Rick, stay on the line. We'll get your name and number and pertinent information so that contact can be made, okay?
Wonderful. I'm glad they'll be
thank
going
you,
to a new good home.
Thank you. I thank you for your generosity, and thank you for your call. You know, I should know this, but how long has the zoo been there?
Well, that's a kind of a funny question because the oldest structure in the zoo, of course, the free flight cage that the Smithsonian did, dates to 1904. We didn't actually found the zoo until 1910.
So long after Forest Park became Forest Park.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Well, what a wonderful spot for it.
Yeah, there was a lot of debate about that, by the way.
A debate about?
Oh, back when the zoo was first put in Forest Park. Mr. Davis, who was then the park commissioner, of course, of Davis.
Dwight Davis?
Yeah, did not want the zoo in the park. And the mayor at the time simply insisted, and he said, Mr. Davis, we won't cut the grass in Forest Park anymore unless you allow the zoo to come in, and that was that.
You know, if it weren't put there, we wouldn't have a zoo, I suspect. I mean, where else might
they
it go?
They had four or five other choices, and one of them was way out in what's now Olivet, I think. And Of course, back then, that might as well have been Kansas City, but they had some choices.
While we're talking about blueprints and early blueprints and what have you, let's talk a little bit about plans. Lots going on, particularly on the south side of the property. Give us some sense of where we are and what you're looking forward to.
Well, let me say on the zoo grounds, we're going to open the polar bear exhibit next year. We have the grizzly bear exhibit coming after that. So we're busy until 2017 on the zoo grounds. On the expansion site across the interstate, right now they're putting down buffalo grass, and it's going to be lovely, but you won't see anything except for, of course, the six-story parking structure, which we renovated. But we're looking at some really exciting things. We never thought that we would be property developers, but we could see a zoo-themed hotel. We could see a destination restaurant. I always give the example of a rainforest cafe, animal-themed hotel, animal-themed restaurant. We would love to do a gondola connecting that site with actually all the way across the zoo, all the way to the living
room. From the old hospital site you're talking
right,
about.
Right.
Yeah. There's been talk of gondolas before, particularly downtown with regard to what's going on down at the Arch, but that's not going to happen.
I don't think anytime soon. We like a gondola because it moves 40 people a minute. I always say imagine a bus with 40 people on it leaving every 60 seconds. It's a lot of people, and I know our visitors will enjoy riding it. And we have to figure out some way of getting people to park on the other side. So you'll see some attractions over there. You'll see some parking, which is one of our biggest needs, getting the cars out of Forest Park.
So what would happen to the current parking lot on the south side?
What a great question. You know, someday I hope that zoo exhibits. And what we've said is that if we can get development on the south side of the interstate on the expansion site, but also get our cars over there, then we have, well, it's actually about 8.6 acres of a parking lot that we can develop into something beautiful and something extraordinary. So we always say we paid a great price for the property across the street because what we really bought was 8.6 acres of Forest Park, and that's priceless.
Along these lines, I have an email from Steve in Olivet who writes, I believe the zoo's long-term master plan raises the possibility of a savanna being built where the south parking lot is now. Is this still envisioned? If so, what's the timetable for development? And can you give us an idea of the kind of animals and features that might be included in such a savanna?
Well, in the first place, I love the idea of a savanna. It really, it's wonderful. It's open space. I can also see perhaps a connection from the new site to our parking lot that takes you, we're a water planet, that takes you from the water world to different habitat areas that we have. So maybe you get to the other side. It's not only a savanna grasslands, but it's also a desert area. It could be more of a deciduous forest area. And you see all those different habitats that are affected by differential rainfall. That could be wonderful. In terms of timing, I don't know. I've always thought, well, first let me say, this is a 25 to 30-year vision. We'd rather do it right than fast. I've always thought that would be the final crown in the jewel, the capstone. So we'll see. But I'm going to bet that's later rather than earlier.
Just out of curiosity, what kind of animals inhabit our denizens of a savanna?
Oh, well, you think of the African savanna. You're going to find this wonderful hoofstock. We always think of zebras and wildebeest. But there's so many other, roan and so many other wonderful animals. And then you've got all the people, all the predators that prey on them. If you've got people too. But so there's a pretty incredible mix of animal life in a savanna.
Well, if you have a savanna, you want to have a high fence too, obviously.
Yes, we would.
This.
That would be a good idea.
Jeffrey Bonner is our guest. He's the president and CEO of the St. Louis Zoo. We're talking about the zoo, various aspects and facets of what goes on there and what's going to be going on there. We'll continue our conversation. Again, we'd like to bring you into it at 382-8255. Give us a call if you'd like to talk to Jeffrey Bonner. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back to our conversation with the CEO and president of the St. Louis Zoo, Jeffrey Bonner. We're talking about the zoo past, present, and future. We want to bring you into the conversation. Jeffrey, before I go back to the phones, what you're talking about is a 30-year plan. I understand that, but all of this costs money. So when are you going to start charging admission to the zoo to pay for it?
Well, let me address the costing money aspect of it first. When you're doing this kind of civic development, it really opens up a lot of sources of funding that the zoo's never been able to take advantage of before. So they're all federal, state, local programs for economic development, their transportation things that might fund things like interesting connections like the gondola. So in some respects, it is a new world for us. As far as charging admission goes, you know, it's against the law. So we begin with that premise. And people have always said, well, the law can be changed. I think that my personal feeling is I love the zoo being free. I love the accessibility that affords to people. It can't go on. It's not a sustainable model. The zoo is working very hard to build its endowment. We've enjoyed enormous success. In the long run, that's going to be the thing that keeps the zoo free, either that or folks in the surrounding counties will want to at some point, I think, help support the zoo. But I think it's important to keep it free.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would certainly agree with that. You know, the San Diego Zoo has a great reputation and is often in the top two or three or five, whatever, in the various kinds of polls that we were talking about. But it costs an arm and a leg to go to the San Diego Zoo.
Yeah, it does. I mean, that's a real impediment to visiting. But I'll tell you, even a modest charge for families with limited means makes it difficult to come. And if you think about it, we want to be able to reach everybody. We want to have those life-changing experiences. For a lot of people, particularly people in the city, but increasingly people that are two or three generations removed from the farm or are not going out in the woods with their kids, mm-hmm. You know, the zoo is the one place where they can begin to address that.
Sure. Let's go back to the phones. A couple of folks have been waiting patiently. Let's start with Chris calling from St. Louis. Chris, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. I thought I'd just add a little bit to the history of the zoo. The first zoological collection in the park actually dated back to 1892 when a small collection was housed over in the Deer Lake area, not far from the Muni. While it's, you know, not the wonderful zoo we have today, there's no connection there. There was an earlier zoo in the park.
Right.
And I was
right.
Wondering if Mr. Bonner wanted to comment on that.
Yeah, there were collections of animals in different places around the city. You know, well prior to that, I think the area that became Sportsman's Park had collections of animals. So it's something that's always been in St. Louis, but it was really a very small group of people that were very farsighted in terms of what they wanted to do that made the zoo today possible. By the way, our mission hasn't changed in 100 years. It's we've had to update the language because the language is kind of archaic, but it's remarkable how prescient those people were.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Ed in Wentzville is waiting. Go ahead, Ed.
Yes. I'm 80 years old, but when I was 15, my first job was working at the St. Louis Zoo in the now-destroyed World's Fair refreshment stand.
Right.
It was a delightful experience, and I can remember it was 1950 because while I was working there, I heard the word of the invasion of North Korea into South Korea. But the keepers were so good to me, I got to see a lot of things behind the scenes that folk normally don't see. But it was a delightful experience. In a sense, you almost had to know somebody to get a job in the zoo back then. I still have the zoo booklet from 1950 and some postcards in my pile of family mementos.
Wonderful.
It was a wonderful experience.
That's great. Yeah, I meet so many people that worked at the zoo. And it's funny because I'll meet somebody in their 50s or 60s that used to work on the train, and they'll proceed to recite the train narrative. And I go, I believe you. It's amazing how many people forever, half a century, remember that stuff.
There are so many memories attached to St. Louisans, or longtime St. Louisans, associated with the zoo. And I hear again and again, my wife is one of them, talks about the chimp shows, you know, of years ago that were so very, very popular.
Yeah, Charlie Hessel, the director before I got to enjoy this fabulous job taking care of your zoo for you, was really I think very smart in looking ahead and thinking to himself that animal shows, particularly the ones that we did, maybe weren't the best way to present those animals to the public. And I think our Sea Lion show does a very good job of doing that, but I think some of those older shows didn't. By the way, I remember them from my childhood vividly.
I think all of us do. Whoever visited a zoo. I saw Charlie Hessel at an event just a couple of weeks ago. He looks great, sounds great.
Yeah.
What
a remarkable man. You know, we've had some great – Marlon Perkins was a great leader. George Vierheller for decades was a marvelous zoo leader. We've been blessed with some – some great folks.
You know, I met Marlon Perkins and got to know him a little bit, and his wife Carol, when I first came to St. Louis, and I felt like I was meeting a rock star. I mean, this guy from Mutual of Omaha shows and all the rest of it. I mean, he was a personality.
You know, what was funny about Marlon was that he was so approachable. I remember when I was younger meeting him and just thinking, wow, he's just a, you know, he's a regular guy. Here's this famous guy, and he's glad to talk to you.
Yeah, he was really, really a good guy. Back to the phones. Aussie is joining us from Florissant. Go ahead, Aussie.
Yeah, hi, Dan. It's been a long time since I've called.
Good.
As a St. Louis County resident, and I've advocated for decades, since St. Louis County residents, St. Louis City residents, okay, contribute tax dollars to support these cultures, the zoo, and et cetera. I believe that surrounding residents should be charged a fee. They, you know, they enjoy it. I don't, you know, I'm glad to help them, but I think they should pay their fair share.
You know, what's interesting about that, I wouldn't necessarily dispute that, but what I will say for the record is they've never been asked to. So before we castigate them for not doing it, we ought to remember that we've never really approached them and said, you know, would you like to do this? And that's the first thing we need to do. But I would say, you know, I don't disagree with you. I think that everybody should pull their own weight. I will say that the St. Louis Zoo is, in terms of tourism, the second most important force in the city. And tourism dollars are new dollars. That's why everybody chases tourism dollars. You're not recirculating old dollars in the community. And I will say that if we ever have a general admission charge, the economic impact on the community would be very, very powerful. And I people don't necessarily realize that because they don't think of the zoo as an enormous economic motor. I think in many ways more important than the Arch. I think that people visit the Arch when they come to St. Louis, but I know for a fact people come to St. Louis to visit the zoo. Very subtle distinction there, but an important one.
But a lot of them are visiting both.
Sure. Too. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Needless to say, I think the Arch gets about $3 million a year too.
Yeah, their attendance is about the same. They're a little more than us, and as a consequence, their tourism base is a little more than ours. But 4 out of every 10 people that come to the St. Louis Zoo are tourists. So that's hugely important to our economy.
I have a number of emails and tweets here I'd like to get to for some. We'll call them quick hits.
Okay.
Mitchell writes, ask if the mandate vision of the zoos have changed over time due to climate change, population of animals, et cetera.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. We're working so hard now. When you see the new polar bear exhibit, it will be about global climate change. We won't be talking about the physiology of bears. We'll be talking about what's happening to their environment and why it is so important to all of us, but bears in particular.
Hope writes concerning the bears, the polar bear exhibit looks a bit small, a lot of concrete where the polar bears have something other than concrete to rest on. Worried about the infamous hot St. Louis summers.
Yeah, that's a wonderful observation. We have a lot of different what we call substrates. So they'll have sand to play in, to roll about in. They'll have grass. They'll have trees. They'll have chilled water. I'll remind everybody that where they live, if you ever go up to Churchill in the summer, it's warm. You know, you're going to have a short sleeve shirts on and shorts. So don't think that polar bears, you know, don't experience warm weather. By the way, it's really interesting. You know, penguins live right up to the equator. So the Galapagos penguin, and you think about South Africa, Australia, places where it doesn't get cold. The problem with our Humboldt penguins is that it gets too cold in the winter, not that it's too hot in the summer. The Humboldts live in a desert.
Well, Alex wanted an update on the penguins. One of those cute, waddling friends returning is the question.
They will return next spring. I'm not ready to give a date yet, but if I weren't doing anything in the month of March, I'd be thinking about penguins.
Uh-huh. Any plans on pandas, Katie asks, or getting another Benny?
Pandas, what an interesting question. We've always said that pandas would be interesting at the zoo. It would cost about $3 million a year to have them. $1 million right off the top goes to the Chinese government. And that seems to me to be a bit exorbitant. And pandas, they have a lot of research money going into them, a lot of conservation dollars. So many other species don't. So I would say that even though pandas would be wonderful at the St. Louis Zoo, there are some issues with regard to their viability.
Yeah, how about, I'm going to ask about breeding them. Is that particularly difficult?
Well, it's they're there's been a lot of attempts in breeding that have resulted in the development of a lot of technology. So now our assisted reproduction, whether it's artificial insemination or what have you, is really exploding. And we've learned an awful lot about panda reproduction, how to house them in such a way that it facilitates breeding behavior. And panda populations are really, really doing well in human care, both in China and in the United States.
Yeah, it's good to hear. They are so popular. Let's take another call. Art joins us from St. Louis. Go ahead, Art.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call there, Don. And between the marshlands behind the Municipal Opera and Moody Lentz, we used to really have a big collection area going for them there. But the point I wanted to make was how extensive is the bush meat trade on the imported meats into this country? And would that be a violation of cultural rights as far as limitations on bush meat imported into this country?
Well, it's huge. Bush meat is a terrible problem, and it does come into the United States. People talk about the ivory trade in tusks all going to China. You know, as it happens, the United States is the second largest importer of illegal ivory. So it's happening here. Is it a violation of cultural rights? Well, you know, is it a violation of the animal's right to survive? It's a legitimate question. I wouldn't say it's not a legitimate question. I would think that the viability of the species far outweighs the tradition or the history of someone to use it.
Yeah. Let's take one more quick call from Malcolm. Malcolm, it has to be quick. Go ahead, in Florissant.
I think the zoo's got a tremendous, fascinating history, and it's transformed itself many times down the years. And when I bring a family from out of town, from Europe, I like to show them around the zoo. Why isn't there a room or a setting where there's a history of the zoo portrayed so that people could really see what the zoo has done to transform itself to down the years of its mission?
We had such an exhibit for 2 years. We redid the oldest actual building on the zoo grounds, 1917 it was built, and put an exhibit in there. It was tremendously enjoyed by people, but I don't think right now we have a lot of space to do that. We're getting a lot more pressure to interpret our conservation efforts worldwide. So even though the history of the zoo is wonderful, it's in books, it's accessible, but we have very, very, you know, precious little space, and we really need to talk about the issues that face wild things in wild places.
Art raised the question in talking about elephants, and you had mentioned poaching a couple of times. I think one of the most heartbreaking things that most of us are reading about these days is what's going on with the ivory and learning how emotional elephants are and watching this happen in their midst.
That's a really interesting observation. I happen to be one of those people that actually believe that, let's just say higher mammals, but animals like you and me, if you will, experience the entire range of emotions that humans experience, maybe a little differently, but they have it, the grief, sorrow, jealousy, anger, love. And I think for a long time we've just systematically, scientists and science in particular, have just really, really been opposed to believing that. And I think that that's gradually changing. I think we're beginning to understand that indeed they do. You're absolutely right. And that these things have a horrible effect on them.
There has been some interesting things written recently about elephants mourning when they come across the carcass of one of their mates that has been slain or one of their number that has been slain, that they literally mourn just as we do.
A lot of recent studies have shown that there's a number of mammals that have self-awareness, that is that they, you know, they can look at themselves and they know that they are something, if you will. They have a personal identity. And we see that in a lot of different animals. It's hard to prove, but we know it's there in dolphins. We know it's there in the higher primates, chimps, and so forth. Right. We absolutely know it's in elephants. And we're finding that kind of information in a lot more species all the time. So, yeah, I think that that's a pretty important thing.
We've only got about a minute left, and I just wanted to raise the issue of bee colony collapse. And amongst the research that you do at the zoo, I understand this is part of that research. What are you learning, if anything?
Yeah, I have a wonderful entomologist. what we say about any extinction event or any threat is that we say multimodal. It's always more than one thing. It's never just one thing. So I think with colony collapse disorder, you know, you're looking at parasites, you're looking at colonies that are weakened because the natural environment maybe has a higher number of pesticides or their host plants are decreasing. You find that with butterflies, monarchs, for example, and milkweed, mm-hmm. but you certainly find it with bees. We're losing native pollinators at an extraordinary rate, and just remind everybody that, you know, a huge percentage of what you eat, you wouldn't eat if it weren't for pollinators. So this is the kind of problem that faces everybody. Very important one.
It's a big deal. There's no question about that. Well, Jeffrey Bonner, I want to thank you so much for being with us. It's always fascinating to talk to you and to talk about what's going on at the zoo. So much is happening. Again, congratulations to you and yours for all the wonderful publicity and the wonderful work you're doing.
Well, thank you for having me.
Good to have you. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll preview the Missouri State Legislature's veto session. It begins on Wednesday. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.